welcome to another episode of Capitol Record. I am so excited. We are now into the month of September, and we are ready to finish the year strong. Lots of good guests coming up, starting with the one I'm going to be bringing on here in just a few moments. For those who don't know, Dr. Ann Bradley is not only a consistent top featured scholar at the Acton Institute, but is Washington, D.C. based, has filled a number of think tank positions. She did her doctoral work, got her PhD in economics from George Mason University nearly 20 years ago, and right now is heavily involved at the Fund for American Studies, has previously served at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. I mentioned being heavily affiliated with the Acton Institute. So Anne's one who's out fighting the good fight in the think tanks, educating students, debating, lecturing, writing. She's in the arena, and she is such a great communicator, such a thoughtful proponent of a market economy, deeply rooted in the tradition of the Christian faith, and has a tremendous understanding of both theology and philosophy necessary to, I think, make the case the way we want to make it at Capitol Record for a free and virtuous society. So with all that said, please welcome to the Capitol Record, Dr. Ann Bradley. So with that said, allow me to welcome yet another first-time guest to the Capitol Record, Dr. Ann Bradley. Ann, welcome to Capitol Record.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
So I have enjoyed having several people who serve with the Acton Institute, like myself, on the podcast. But of course, most of us that are affiliated with Acton, with a couple exceptions, have other day jobs. Maybe you could start by telling the listeners some of the other things that fill your time.
Sure. Oh, well, thank you. I'd love to. Well, I'm an Acton affiliate scholar, and I've done that for several years. I also, my primary job is I work at the Fund for American Studies. We're an educational organization in Washington, D.C., and our primary goal is to bring students to Washington, although we have a few international programs, for a semester of interning and also taking classes. So I'm a faculty member there, as well as their vice president for economic initiatives. And I'm also a full professor at the Institute of World Politics, which is also in Washington, D.C. So I have a couple of hats that I wear.
And how long has Washington, D.C. been home?
Forever. I'm actually from the Virginia suburbs. So I'm from Alexandria. I now live in Loudoun County. So we kind of continue moving west so we can afford to have a house. But it's very different than it was when I was growing up. But yeah, always, I guess, a Washingtonian by birth.
And in terms of the particular, when you talk about the Fund for American Studies, is the specific focus there in those educational initiatives related to markets?
Yes. Yeah, so our, you know, kind of one of our guiding principles is that we want people to understand the economic way of thinking in both theory and practice. So the students have classroom experience. We try to walk them through economics. And as you can imagine, I mean, our summer programs can have up to 400 students for the whole summer. So we have a lot of students, a lot of different majors, and many of them come to Washington wanting to change the world. They have a lot of passion, but they haven't been equipped to think economically about how you do that. So that's really one of our primary goals in the classroom. And they can take a variety of different classes to do that. I've traditionally taught a policy-oriented class or a trade class. And so we really try to get into the nuts and bolts of how economics can help them. It's kind of the glasses, right, for the world. So if we put those glasses on, then we can better understand good policies from policies that might actually be disastrous but sound good. So we really work with them deeply. And then we place them in internships so they can see the pragmatic application, right, of how to change policy, how to work in a think tank, that type of thing.
I love it. I absolutely love it. That nexus of theory and practice together, I suppose, is too often ignored, and seems to serve as a sort of virtuous cycle. The one animates the other and then rinses and repeats.
That's right.
Now, I know that you did your doctoral work at George Mason, and I wonder, did you find at studying at a renowned economics program, particularly known for being sympathetic to free market thought, that George Mason had a lot of others, faculty or fellow students, with a faith orientation to the way they approached the discipline?
So, you know, when I started there, it was 2000, and it's certainly a much bigger program and a more robust program, I think, today than it was then, but it was wonderful then. And I don't know that I would say I was drawn to there because there were people of faith that were thinking about the intersection of faith and markets. I think that happened for me more after my graduate studies. But what I love about George Mason, and I think, again, because the program has grown and there's a lot of really great scholars also through the Mercatus Center there, is that there are scholars that either have or do work on the intersection of faith and markets, or they support it because they understand it's important. So, you know, it's a heterodox approach to economics. It is, we need to think about philosophy. We need to think about sociology. We need to think about culture. All these things are important for the economist to fully understand and be a student of the world. And I think that's really the power of George Mason, is that they're not trying to cultivate technocrats as such. What they want you to do as a student is ask interesting questions. And so those questions about the intersection of faith and freedom and the philosophy or the theology of freedom are very much welcomed at a place like George Mason. So now I think that there are a lot of graduate students coming out of George Mason that are doing their dissertations on this type of work. And that's really exciting. So that's just kind of the intellectual environment you get there, which is why that's the only place I wanted to go. So I'm glad it worked out.
Well, I think it's splendid. Do you believe that the secular nature of a lot of our Austrian forefathers held back our cause a bit? Do you think their sort of lack of an anthropological foundation or consistency has made the work people like you and me harder now today as we try to make the case for a free and virtuous society? It's a tricky issue for me. I'll tell you the context of the question is, I freely talk about all the time that I lack the ability philosophically to really, with the most animated spirit possible and intellectual consistency, make the case for markets I want to make apart from a theology of creation and apart from certain anthropological truths I believe about God and man and society. And yet I also speak to the fact that von Mises and Hayek and Milton Friedman were three just unbelievable influences on my thought in the 20th century. And so I wonder, even with more contemporaries like George Mason today, is there a sense in which something is still missing in that Austrian anthropology?
I do think that we need more of those types of questions. And so it's interesting that you asked that. I would say I'm in the middle of at least two different papers, but sometimes two papers becomes four because I have a lot to say, I suppose. But really of connecting the Austrian way of thinking about praxeology of human action, that has to be nestled in a proper understanding of human anthropology and human nature. And so I think if you read Hayek and Mises and even go back to Smith, I think you see it, but I think we need to make it more explicit. So I think you see touches of it, but what I want to do is have a comprehensive Austrian understanding of the nature of man and to say that human nature is not fungible. And that's why the Austrians are right about their economics, right? So I do think we need to unpack those anthropological understandings and see that some of our assumptions as economists really stem from anthropological truths that have not been maybe researched or thought about or explicitly laid out in the ways they want them to. So I'm agreeing with you. I don't think it's been blatantly ignored. I think it's there. But again, I think that people who come from a faith-based perspective we have a natural inclination to go there, and maybe many secular economists can respect the importance of Christianity, but not necessarily take all of their economics back to their faith or to a faith, if that makes sense. And so I do think there's more work to be done there.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I wonder sometimes if what you say about the fungibility of human nature, there's this component of Mises praxeology that is brilliant about universality of human nature, and that we would agree with it. It's just that there's a difference between people who get wrong premises and right conclusions, and that can be frustrating and challenging enough. But in their case, it's almost not wrong premises and right conclusions. It's incomplete premises, missing imago Dei, missing the original sin, missing some of the creational components. And I think then even just the nature of God and man are the reality of our individuality, not inconsistent with us being a social creature. And people could argue that what we believe about man's eternal destiny is irrelevant to where we go with economics. I don't think it is irrelevant, but I would just say that there's a few things that color in so much of Austrian praxeology in creational economics that I would just love to get one last coffee with Hayek if I could.
Absolutely. And I there's this little line in The Road to Serfdom. And to me, it's one sentence that is just kind of, you could write pages on this one sentence, but he talks about the importance of Christianity for understanding individual decision-making and the way individuals, kind of the dignity of individuals in society. So it's one little sentence, right? When he's thinking about the road to serfdom, and the road to serfdom is important because he's saying, this is where you're going to end up. The promise isn't serfdom, but that's where you get, right? So you're stripped of your dignity. You live under kind of authoritarianism. You don't have economic freedom. All the things that he talks about, and that there's a warning of there. But it's just one little sentence, and then he moves on. So I agree with you on having coffee with Hayek, because it makes me wish that he would have talked more about what that meant to him. If it was an afterthought or I'm not sure. So I don't want to put words in his mouth because I don't know. But I do think that's a very profound sentence, and it's something that I latch onto. And as you said, I think creation gives us a lot of information about how to think about sin, our finitude, but also being created in the image and likeness of God and having purpose. Yeah. So if we approach economics that way, economics is necessarily a humanitarian pursuit. Imagine if we led with that. That's exciting, right? That's not just what happened to GDP last quarter, which is important, but it's certainly not everything. But nobody cares, right? I mean, this is like the way to get people to run away from you at cocktail parties. Just start talking about GDP and they will leave because they don't think it's relevant. But if we talk about economics in the context of the quest for human flourishing, that's exciting. But I don't think you can do that without these creational truths, as you have put that. I like that phrase.
Certainly not consistently do it. And the reason I wrote my book last year, There's No Free Lunch, and am on this sort of crusade right now to kind of reframe the way in which we make the case, is I believe the majority of people, there's a minority that are socialistic. There's a minority that are actinized, meaning make an argument for free enterprise with all of the theological foundations self-consciously that we have. The majority, I think, are not socialistic. They're generally supportive of markets and view them as pretty good arbiters of risk and reward, as I like to say, but lacking that sort of foundation, they can fall prey to a sort of Randian temptation when things are going well. And then kind of lack a defense against the claim that markets are ultimately vehicles for selfishness and greed and exploitation. And I usually kind of wince when I hear people who don't have that foundation try to defend markets against that accusation. I think that this that what we're trying to offer is the most holistic apologetic for a free society. It not only makes the humanitarian case you refer to, but it also makes the production first case. It's the ultimate anti-Keynesianism, that mankind was made to be productive, and we start with production and economic activity, and in fact do so because God himself was productive and made us in his image to be such. And I really have found it to be not only very satisfying in my own journey, but very persuasive with others. It's not as hostile. I would have had a very difficult time growing up trying to defend markets purely and exclusively in a Randian construct.
And yeah, because at the end of the day, we will all leave this world, and you can't take your Mercedes with you. And that's not, the Mercedes is nice if you can have it. So I agree with you. I think that it's not just about stuff for the sake of stuff, but it's about creativity and unleashing human creativity, and through that empowering human agency, which is what it means to live into our, I think, God-given purpose. And so I couldn't agree with you more. And really, again, I think that this flips the conversation when we think about poverty as well, right? Because poverty is the, in Poverty Inc., of course, a incredible documentary done by the folks at Acton, they talk about poverty as the exclusion, being excluded from markets, being excluded from trade, being excluded from commerce and exchange. And that's exactly right. And so that flips the way we think about it. It's that we want people in the underdeveloped world to grow their incomes, not just because we want them to get one day I get to have a Mercedes or something, right? But it's like the process of creative production is who we are. Yep. And the benefits of that are more abundance and more responsibilities with that abundance. So it's not just a free lunch, as you know, it's not just more stuff and then I die someday. It's more stuff. And I like to think about, in the earlier passages of Genesis 2:15, we're told to work the garden and care for it. And if you look at the word that's used in the Hebrew, it's abad. A translation of abad is to serve. So through being productive, we are serving not only ourselves, but other people. Now, that's not always the case, right? Because that takes a market economy. A market economy means that in my own quest to help myself, I'm induced to help others. But if you live in a non-market economy, if you think about episodes of socialism or communism, and I agree with you, I think most people aren't kind of hardcore socialists. But I do think people have questions about what are the limits of markets, right? But if you think about a non-market economy, people are producing, but they don't have the incentives to share the productive gains with others. They actually have the opposite incentives, just take more for myself, and then, you're on your own kind of thing.
Well, I think one of the most effective techniques generally in argumentation is the idea of using the opponent's argument to demonstrate how they themselves are guilty of what they're accusing you of. And my late father was a well-known Christian intellectual in the field of apologetics and talked a lot about the atheist having to borrow from the Christian worldview to assume laws of logic and science and morality. Which, after borrowing from the Christian worldview, would then use those things to turn around and try to undermine the case for a Christian worldview. And I love Milton Friedman's undermining on the Phil Donahue show about the notion of a market economy being a vehicle for greed, and pointed out that the people talking about greed and wanting something different are generally state actors, as if we're supposed to believe that state actors don't operate from a state of greed, right? That they're basically guilty of the thing that they may be accusing others of. The issue you're bringing up, the long segue here, is I think that the accusation of those of us who are defenders of abundance and prosperity in a market economy are accused of materialism. And yet when it comes to poverty and humanitarian concern, it seems to me that these other vehicles of poverty alleviation are incredibly materialistic. that they would assume that all we need to do is to give people things. And yet when we talk about it, and you used the expression a while ago, human flourishing, it's words that anyone who listens to people like us talk long enough will hear all the time. But human flourishing has always had both a material and immaterial component to it. And I truly believe that poverty alleviation, properly understood, has a strong sense of not relying only on the material to provide people happiness and that purpose, that telos that we're talking about. And within our view of market economy, not only do we have better incentives, as you say, to meet the needs of humanity, but we don't become content to view roughly half of the world's population as mere recipients of our productivity. We invite them into the production process. And I think that is incredibly anti-materialistic.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I am very influenced by Jonathan Pennington's work on human flourishing. I think he really has a robust biblical understanding of what that means. And if you read his description, which is an exegetical approach to trying to understand it, it is biblical human flourishing is not only immaterial, which is, when you're talking to theologians, that can be a controversial statement, right? But when you're talking to other people, the flip side of that can be controversial, which is to say, we're saying it's both. I think that's your point, which is to say, to have human flourishing, to live long lives, to be healthy, to be free, to be able to enjoy family and neighborhoods and to produce, right? To produce and go to work, you have to be healthy. And so that requires economic production. And if you look at just, so basically what I'm saying is I could not agree more with your point, but you know, if you look at the long track record of human history, people died at very early ages and they just stayed stagnant in their incomes for a very long time. And then something radically changed, right, that changed that. And so you're kind of, we're in the age of superabundance. And the superabundance alone, just having more stuff, having more iPads, all those things aren't going to save us or fill our soul with, you know, kind of the non-material things. But they are an important element of human flourishing. And I think the conversation gets truncated too often. So in the theological camp, I think you do have people who are not socialists, but who kind of reject material progress because they think it's somehow anathema to their faith. And then I think you have kind of secular socialists who end up being completely materialistic in what they advocate for because they totally leave out all the spiritual elements of human flourishing. So I think we have a lot of work to do there. It's a big topic and it's none of this is easy. And convincing and having thoughtful conversations, that's not easy either.
But when we go back to that item we were discussing earlier about creational economics and this sort of theological worldview that might underpin what we believe, it's something that Father Sirico has really taught me well over the years. The reason I believe, as you do, in human flourishing is having both a material and spiritual component is because I believe man has a physical and spiritual component. The material and immaterial dimensions of human nature are to me, very present and clear, and therefore the definition of human flourishing has to kind of address both of those dimensions of man. And it strikes me that as a challenge for those who don't believe in the immateriality of mankind's soul, destiny, presence, that it would be harder to define human flourishing the way we do if you didn't have that view of man that we do. And it would be more tempting to go down a purely materialistic construct, whether it be in a leftist way such as Marxism, but even a real right-wing, I could see a right-wing materialistic defense of markets also being very unsatisfying.
Mm-hmm. And I, you know, at the end of the day, I think people know this. I think you could be surrounded by all the stuff in the world and be miserable. And so I think it's a very important and crucial point, an existential point, if you will, for us. So thinking about what type of society allows us to develop ourselves spiritually and physically and materially, those are the questions we want to have with people on the right or the left who might disagree with us. I think those are kind of how we frame the questions. And I do think what it does, it allows you to rise above just the greed is good type of argument that a lot of our friends make, by the way. I mean, a lot of my, you know, friends in my economic circles, this is like a sexy title, right? Greed is good because it sounds very provocative. But at the end of the day, none of those people would support unmitigated greed, right? They would know that, like, the reason that markets are good is because they constrain the greed, because they take the greed from a Smithian perspective and they transform it into service. It's not that you can change the human heart, but you can change the incentives. And for us as Christians, that's only part of it, right? We want to change the incentives so people do actually serve each other through entrepreneurship and discovery and all that kind of thing. But we also want to be disciples of Christ. So I think it's just a different kind of conversation that we're having here.
Absolutely. Well, so right now when you are engaged in the daily endeavors that you are, do you find a changing of the guard taking place in the sort of intellectual environment, that there is becoming a skepticism from even some on the right about markets? You talked earlier about the limits of markets. We hear a lot these days about market orthodoxy being somewhat perilous and common good conservatism. How pulled into some of this growing dialogue have you gotten?
Well, a little bit. So, you know, I've been a little bit concerned about what you're talking about, which is kind of people broadly, I would say broadly on the right, kind of turning their backs or rejecting markets. I think we're seeing a lot more of this. I think it started with thinking about free trade and restrictions on free trade. I think the pandemic also just accelerated some of those feelings because it brought massive global insecurities. Anyway, I think there's a lot of things that have gone on recently to kind of accelerate this resistance to markets. I find it very concerning. I think it is not based on sound economic thinking. And so I'm a little bit in that debate. And I think it's an important one to have, because I think, here's the thing, you know, this is what I tell my students all the time. I say, because I teach a lot of policy classes, and so they love to talk about, the first day they want to talk about the policies. And I say, the first day we're going to talk about supply and demand and incentives, and we have to build the foundation of the house we're going to live in. So we can't go to the second floor and talk about policies until we have the first floor, right? It's ready to go. So I always tell them, you have to pack your principles with you when you go to a policy fight, right? They got to be in your suitcase. You take them with you. And so I think what I'm seeing now with people on the right is, you know, and I'm just speaking in generalities when I say the right, is that there's a willingness perhaps to kind of walk back on some of the gains we've made in terms of international trade relationships and the reduction of those barriers over, say, the past four decades, and kind of a rethinking of what's the difference between free trade and free markets. And so I do think the principles of economics are always true, even if they are not politically accepted at the time. And so to have these conversations today, I view my job as injecting the principles time and time again. So my colleague, who both is in the George Mason Economics Department and also is a teacher with us at TFAS, his name is Don Boudreau. He's wonderful. And he, you know, he says, we're always teaching principles of economics. No matter what course you're teaching, no matter what op-ed you're writing, it's always tied back to the principles. And he's right. So no matter what kind of, you know, trade deficits, budget deficits, whatever we're talking about, we're always going to go to the principles. And so that's what I find concerning, to answer your question, is that, you know, it's politically maybe more attractive right now on the right to say, let's kind of walk away from some of this market stuff. But I think the principles are true because they're true and they're timeless, and we need to inject the principles into the conversation.
Well, and I think, Anne, what seems to be complicating it is that There are some, I, by the way, just can't even tell you how much I agree with you and your, and even borrow some of that same language. When we talk about first things and first principles, I love that expression, you know, pack your principles in your briefcase when you go to a policy debate. All the teaching I try to do on the subject is rooted in holding that foundation. But see, if what we were dealing with is a growing group of people that want to violate the principles, that are willing to operate inconsistently, like, yes, we've said this and this, but in this case, we're deciding to make an exception. Some degree of either economic or political or just broader intellectual inconsistency has always been with us. The problem is some of them are not taking the bait. They are saying, yeah, you're right, those principles are wrong. And with it, not merely calling into question some of the general principles that undergird a market economy, but even a liberal order. And that's where I think we're in for a bit of a debate for quite some time. It's going to be, some are a little more political and crass and transactional than others. If it were just Twitter wars, I wouldn't care as much. But there's some formidable foes, and I agree. I think a lot of it did start with the trade subject. At least that's where it started getting a bit more popular. And of course, it had a certain embodiment manifestation in the political moment of the last 5, 6, 7 years. But I think that on a go-forward basis, I fear a lot of people on the right playing into it as, yeah, you're right, we have learned that markets really failed us. And now we need to call an audible for how the state can become a better ally in what it is we want to accomplish, whether it be an industrial policy or mercantilism or just various aspects of the culture war, for that matter. I am concerned, and frankly, Orrin Cass, who I consider a friend, and I've had him on this podcast, we still have a third debate we have to do, but he and I had a very cordial debate on trade. We pretty much disagree with each other on from head to toe on the subject, and a second one on financial markets, which is a fascinating subject to me. It's what I do for a living, and there's a real hostility coming in from many on the right against Wall Street and robust capital markets that we perceive to be somehow antithetical, anti-labor, you know, problematic for the cause. I think that those things are getting against first principles, and yet some people just seem real willing to say, fine, I'll abandon the first principles.
It is, I don't know, I mean, I could fill up the rest of our time together with this, so I won't do that. But this is a hill I will die on. I can say that to you right now. I mean, I've been in these debates. I've spoken with Orrin Cass as well. We have very different views on these types of things. This is not him. I will leave names out. But I was in kind of a colloquium format where a bunch of people who disagreed were having a debate, and I was told, you know, I'm an economist, okay? So I was told to my face that comparative advantage just doesn't work. And like this, I don't even know how to process that, because we have hundreds of years of economics, both people on the left and people on the right, who understand that comparative advantage does work, right? Comparative advantage is the notion that you should trade with a person who has the lowest relative opportunity cost. And so, you know, that runs very much counter to the new en vogue kind of industrial policy calls, right? Which is maybe don't import things from China or Vietnam or wherever it may be, but make it at home or these types of things. I mean, there's nothing new about the objections that are being brought by modern industrial policy advocates. There's just nothing new under the sun. Yeah. But there's nothing new under the sun about the idea of comparative advantage that's tried and true. So my response, which was a little bit snarky, I'll admit, because I was just so flabbergasted to have that said to me, you know, just like comparative advantage doesn't work. I'm thinking, what? I said, well, if you're wearing a suit that you did not make from scratch, comparative advantage works.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, you know, we have to think through the principles and just Shine a light.
I don't think that's snarky at all. If that's your version of snarky, then you would really be uncomfortable with some things I say sometimes, but because I think it's a great illustration of your point, and it's almost a sort of a more modernized take illustration from Leonard Reed's Eye Pencil. You know what's interesting though? Cass does not say comparative advantage doesn't work. He attacks it on the basis of what Smith had in mind in his anti-mercantilism would be countries that are literally trading natural resources with one another. And that once you implement a current account deficit, and so the financial component, right? In other words, obviously, we know that it is equaling out. No one's willing to trade 5 for 3. And so we get 5 and then give back 3 plus $2 of cash and even it out. His argument is that the usage of financial markets to even out the ledger doesn't work to the law of comparative advantage the way Smith advocated. I think he's really wrong, and I think there's an economic reason he's wrong, but that's a bit more nuanced than those who will just flat out tell you that comparative advantage doesn't work. And there's, as you point out, there's more and more that are explicitly saying it, that some of these fundamental laws of economics are no longer at play, just as they're also willing to sort of dismiss the notion of a pluralistic society, of a liberal order, things like that. So I guess it's important for people like you and me, because first of all, I'm always encouraged to hear that, another strong intellectual in the public square like yourself has not thrown in the towel. You're on the good side. We're fighting the good fight together. I think we're going to need our alliances and support and friendships, because I don't think this thing's going away. I thought it was a few years ago, but it does seem to me right now that it's gone past the sort of age-old Jacksonian impulse and populist, elitist, divide within the right. I think it's become a, not new right, but just an undermining of the right. And economically, without those first principles, we're not going to win the debate.
I agree. And here's what I'm most worried about. If you push on the economic principles with some of these folks, they will just, as you said, reject them out of hand. And so the problem with that is that, you do need to know what some economic, you need to have some economic understanding to make some of these sophisticated economic arguments. That's not me saying I'm smarter than Orrin Cass or anybody else, but a study of the discipline of economics is important for making proclamations about how economics works. And so if you're going to reject that, it's like if I go to the doctor and I say, I have a sore throat and I looked at WebMD and WebMD says I might have throat cancer. And your doctor says, no, I just did a test and you have strep throat. Here's an antibiotic. And you say, you're wrong. Yeah. This is like kind of how the conversation goes. So I think what we have to do is find a winsome way to compel other people who listen to the spokesman for new industrial policy. Mm-hmm. It's not my job to change Orrin Cass's mind. I don't think I can do that, but it is my job to rebut the arguments with sound economic thinking, because they're dangerous arguments. I really truly think they're dangerous arguments. And if people start showing up and voting for people based on a false perception of how international trade works or international markets or, as you said, financial markets work, we are in trouble. Yeah. We are in trouble. So I think that's our job, is not necessarily to convert the converted, but to speak truth to the unconverted who are listening.
And I'm hopeful that we can maintain a permission structure for some of the politicians that get caught in the middle of this thing, and maybe you're not the sharpest tools in the shed, to not feel that they have to get pulled into it. It's one thing that the right has swayed so much on free trade over the last 6-7 years. And admittedly, as you say, then COVID and China and a lot of other things, what started off really is just a pro-tariff, this will save jobs in Ohio, rank mercantilism. turned into a human rights thing with China and other stuff, and that invited some complications that I think might be healthy for us to discuss. I'm all for it, but that isn't where it started, and yet all of a sudden the GOP flipped from a 75% free trade party to a 25% free trade party. But I think stuff like Marco Rubio starting this thing about every board in America for a public company should be compelled to have a laborer on the board of directors. And I think, okay, where is something like that's coming from is somewhat cynical and political and so forth. But I also believe that he believes it would work and so forth because this is the direction that the right is now going. And the notion of the unintended consequences of the total impropriety of the federal government telling a private board who they should and shouldn't have on their board, the potential of really unqualified people being on a board, and just the nature of free transactions and who should have jurisdiction for board placement and who shouldn't. Though you're right, these are first principle things, and yet you see someone like Rubio going down that path, and you just think, okay, we have some work to do here.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to comment on that you said just now, but also a little bit before, is I think the pushback that I have, it's not that, I mean, we don't live in a global free market economy. We lived in a mixed economy. So there's lots of interventions, there's lots of subsidies, there's lots of constraints on markets everywhere. So I think we can have many conversations about how to improve those conditions. And to your point earlier, I think we should take seriously the critiques that people bring to markets. And that is a thoughtful and good thing to do. But this is where I have a problem with those on the right who want, you know, the Rubio suggestion that you just mentioned, or just even in general, allowing, you know, and maybe it was when you were talking about Cass, but the notion there, not just him, but others that are kind of in that circle, you know, they say markets don't work the way we thought they did, and therefore we need more government regulation, oversight, whatever you want to call it, interaction with markets. He doesn't want to kill them, but he wants to kind of modify them. So the response that I have over and over and over again to that is that what about everything we've learned from the study of public choice economics, which is to say the economics of politics, the economics of collective action. What we know is true stems from our understanding of human nature, which is people are sinful, both in politics, in the market, in church, in, you know, anywhere, in the library, like, right, they're people. And so what we have to worry about is power. And so the people on the new right, or whatever we're calling them, they want more power over markets, and their assumption is their people will always have the levers of power, and so it's going to be okay because they're going to do the right thing. Again, there's nothing new about this argument, but history has shown time and time again that that's not right, that the power gets in the hands, that the Rubios get power and then they want more power, and that's just human nature. And so I think that this idea that we need more government oversight of markets is so dangerous because, you know, even if they did have power for a time and we could assume they would supposedly do good things with, which I'm not on board with that at all, then what happens when it's not in their hands? Right now you just have a Leviathan, which is out of control.
Well, and not just what happens if it's on their hands, but when it's not in their hands. As you say, this is the lesson of history. It was my favorite line near the conclusion of a debate Father Sirico did with Rusty Reno at King's College when they're talking about we need these committees to regulate this and oversee this. And Father looked at him and said, your people are not going to be on those committees. You're not going to get to fill those committees. Maybe you can start off with a couple of you, but over time. And I think that this is where even, you know, I was talking earlier about Hayek's maybe lack of the Christian foundation, but one thing he got so right in his critique of central planning is he was not critiquing bad central planning. He was critiquing central planning. Whether we like the person doing it or not, whether they get something right here and there or not, that the central planner lacks the knowledge, and we would all add lacks the incentives to properly do it. And when we start throwing in some of the particular issues of the day that maybe have frustrated us, or we are trying to accelerate a resolution to around trade or you know, representation of laborers, when we start thinking central planning will become a solution, I just think we're really stepping outside of what I thought we had learned 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we have to kind of find ways to reshare and retell these stories, because I think you're right. I think that especially in the post-1989 world, I think a lot of people thought the battle of ideas was won.
Yeah.
Right? Hayek was right. Friedman was right. Mises was right. I mean, socialism doesn't work. We're done with that episode. Let's move on. And so, you know, but it's right under our nose. Venezuela is an example. Cuba is, there's so many examples today. And I don't know why the lessons aren't as loud and clear. And so this is something we have to work on in the classroom, from my point of view, but I think it's also something we need to do in the public square, right? Is to say central planning by any other name is still central planning. And your point about what Hayek was doing, my favorite article, The Use of Knowledge in Society,
yeah. Masterpiece,
right? Published in 1945 in the American Economic Review. He is going inside the system and it's imploding, right? So he's not saying, it's not an ideological argument. It's none of that. It's this is why economics is about efficacy, okay? And Hayek is making an argument about efficacy. The reason that it doesn't work is because there's no way to get the knowledge you need to figure out how to solve the economic problem, right? And the economic problem always changes because it's how to best use the given resources at any, you know, at any moment in time.
Time and place, circumstances.
Yes. And so the people who want to open the door for more government power, we need to go back and relearn those lessons, I think.
Yeah.
Because maybe we forgot them, or maybe we're lazy, or maybe we think, I do think that there's this kind of, in American policymaking, there's this like a little bit of a superiority complex or something where we think, okay, we're the good guys. So we're never going to be like the bad guys, right? But if you divorce yourselves from the first principles, you'll become the bad guys. So freedom, we have to be vigilant about both the ideas and the institutions of the Free Society Project. That's what we have to do.
You know what? It's such a great point, Anne. It's really convicting because I think there's a triumphalist impulse in all of us that wants to do a victory lap. I think you're right. Post-89, people have, over the years, been so critical of Fukuyama about the notion of the end of the world as we knew it. The fact of the matter is, this is true in economic ideology. It's true in any application of political philosophy. Reagan had that beautiful line when he was leaving office, that no battle is ever really lost because no battle is ever fully, completely won. And I have said things like that, like case closed, you know, like history is spoken. And I think you're right. I think we have to avoid that because it is somewhat anti-vigilance. It invites people to come back in. And all it takes is a historical moment. And this may be tautological, but history seems full of historical moments. I think the one we're living in was the financial crisis. I think that if the show 30-something was still the number one show on TV and Reagan was popular and GDP was growing 5, 6, 7%, real GDP was growing 5, 6, 7% a year, and they make the Wall Street movie with Greed is Good, and people don't even know that they're trying to say it critically. They love it, and he becomes a culturally iconic, all that. If that's what we were living in, it would be a very different landscape. But the financial crisis then came, you know, a decade and a half later, what have you. And we were back on our heels. And we were totally ill-prepared to argue when people said, see, markets failed, more government intervention, more government programs needed. And it's exactly what happened. Post-Depression and New Deal economics, And we fell for it then, and we've fallen for it again. And it opened the door to a left-wing populism of Bernie Sanders and AOC and Occupy Wall Street and all of that stuff. But it also opened the door to right-wing populism. And I just think these historical moments are where we have to be more prepared.
I agree. I think I would add in 9/11 as another kind of example of a pivotal moment in one's life where you're brought to your knees in fear. Now, it was different, right? People weren't saying 9/11 was a failure of markets. So it's different than your example of the Great Recession, which I think, you know, people viewed as a failure of markets. And I think it's a hard case to make that the Great Recession is actually a failure of regulation. It's not a failure of markets. It's a failure of regulation. It is, I mean, again, I think the other issue that I take very seriously, and I think a lot of us should be talking about, is privilege, cronyism. I don't even like the word crony capitalism. I don't like capitalism with adjectives is what I say, because I think capitalism describes the way resources are allocated versus socialism, which is another way resources are allocated. But in people's minds, capitalism got us the Great Depression. It got us the Great Recession, right? And so these moments, though, thinking of my lifetime, big moments, 9/11, the Great Recession, and COVID, yeah, right? So right. It's people are brought to their knees and they're afraid. And what happens when people are afraid? They say, okay, government, save me. Protect me from another terrorist attack tomorrow. Protect my finances. I don't have to move out of my home. Protect me from a virus. And I think we have to have realistic expectations about what government is able to do and what it's not able to do. But in those moments, it's hard to speak into that noise. It's very hard. So I think, to your point, this is an ongoing battle. It will never have an end. We'll make progress. The tide will turn back. So our job is vigilance. But in spite of all that, how depressing that sounds, think about the economic and flourishing gains we've made of just over the past 50 years. And that's not just the United States, it's globally. I mean, it's an amazing time to be alive. I think we should be optimists. I think optimism doesn't sell politically because if the sky isn't falling, then you can't vote on somebody to fix it, right? So I'm never going to run for office because I'm an optimist. I mean, but I think that optimism stems from my understanding of economics, which is rooted in my faith. I have reason for hope. So I don't know. That was a lot of me musing on some of the things we've been talking about. But I think that the fear of the moment leads to the tyranny of the moment. And we need to watch out for that.
Amen. Every single thing you just said are some of the animating beliefs of my life. I love it. I am an optimist. I had Mark Skousen on some time back, and I consider myself pretty Austrian in most ways, but we were talking about how one of the most upsetting things about the Austrians has actually been this sort of pessimism that often does come along with the worldview, and it doesn't need to be. But to your point, the optimism is rooted in to some degree in a faith and also our understanding of history and our belief about the future. I cannot tell you how grateful I am for the work you're doing. I thank you for spending this time with us today here on the podcast, and I really hope that you'll come back on Capitol Record another time, man.
I would love it. Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Well, thus concludes another episode of Capitol Record. To be honest with you, if I had tried to put a little effort into finding some things that Ann and I disagreed with, I don't think I could have done it. We really are kindred spirits. I not only love where she's coming from and what her chosen points of emphasis are, her commitment to first principles, what excites her, the things that excite me, what frustrates her, the things that frustrate me, but I just love the way that she makes the case. I love her presentation. I love her rhetorical giftedness. And I hope you all will follow Dr. Bradley. We need more like her. Her scholarship is pristine. And we are engaged in an intellectual adventure that, as she pointed out, we have to stay vigilant. These debates will not win themselves. And when it feels that we have won, there's always someone who could be knocking at the door. But if you believe in the ideas, if you believe in the principles firmly enough, then you will stay vigilant, because the cause of a free and virtuous society is going to require it. If that were not the case, there'd be no need for a podcast at Capitol Record. But we have got to keep doing what we're doing to defend free enterprise, to defend capital markets, because vigilance is required. The battle of ideas makes it such. Thank you for listening to The Capitol Record. Please review us, rate us, forward us, subscribe to us. We truly appreciate your support. And I really mean what I say. I know it takes a few sentences and a few seconds and all that, but if you're willing to just click the little button and write up a quick review, we love the feedback, and it really, really helps help grow the profile through the different podcast players to get that kind of exposure of your rating and review. Thanks for listening to Capitol Record.